Right, everybody, it's Thursday. It's the week after our last magazine deadline day. That means it's podcast day. This is Linux Voice. I'm Andrew James Gregory.
I'm Benjamin Arthur Everard.
I'm Graham MacDonald Morrison.
And I'm Mike Colonel Saunders.
And together we comprise the Linux Voice podcast. This is Series 3, Episode 15. In this fun-packed podcast, we've got news, we've got the discoveries of the fortnight, or finds of the week, or whatever it is we're calling it nowadays. We've got a halfway reminder. We may or may not have some vocalise your neurons. Yes, Mike's holding a thumb. He's holding a thumb aloft.
Yep.
In the ancient gladiatorial symbol for death. And there's a voice of the masses, which is going to be unusually brief this time.
I just remembered I said I'd draw a picture and bring it along, but I haven't.
Oh no.
Well, we have some pictures of penguins that we did from the last time we did a similar voice of the masses. So we can just repurpose them because they're Creative Commons licensed.
Good idea, good idea. And John Roberts was the best one there anyway.
He was, yeah.
A couple of issues ago, I reviewed, I can't even remember what it was called now, but it's a collaborative web-based drawing app, so we could all log on to that now, and as we're going along, just each draw a penguin online, and the listeners will be able to log in as well and add theirs, if only I could remember what it was called.
If only. Speaking of how John Roberts was the best, who's doing news?
John Roberts Lightning News, do you remember that?
Yes.
Right, shall I step into John Roberts' shoes and
sorry Ben,
do lightning news in apparently a subpar way?
No, it's brilliant. It's 95% of the podcast now, which is great.
Right, first up on the Lightning News, the Alliance for Open Media has formed. This is an organisation that brings together Amazon, Cisco, Google, Intel, Microsoft, Mozilla and Netflix to create the next generation of video codecs in a sort of open, patent-friendly, not trying to block you watching videos kind of way. So between them, these organisations have the Dialer codec, Thor, and the VP910, etc. codec. So it's a fair amount of video codec might in one organisation pledging to create open codecs. And considering what a mess video codecs have been for so long, this is seems like very good news to me.
But we already have these codecs in the form of VP9 and stuff, don't we? What are they trying to do?
Well, it's to sort of bring it together, because one of the problems is, yeah, there's VP9 for Google, but then what, you know, that it's getting the same codecs to work on every device. It's creating standards for how things should work. It's releasing code. They've been releasing their code under the Apache license. It's bringing the efforts together to create the right codec that works everywhere, rather than having everyone creating half a codec that sort of works on their devices.
But do they want DRM to be part of this?
Well, they didn't say on their website.
Mm.
Obviously, looking at that list, there's no organisations there that are really pro-DRM. Obviously, Netflix and Amazon use DRM, but not sort of, they don't push it. Mozilla obviously likely to be fighting against it.
What about it's like patent indemnity?
They've pledged to, yeah, license their patents in a sort of royalty-free way to make it, possible to re-implement.
That's good. I mean, Google's made this promise before with its own codecs, but nothing. I mean, I was just thinking, however many years we've been doing this, we've had, I don't know, maybe half a dozen of this similar stories of almost exactly the same story. And considering just how fundamental, you know, video now is to the internet, it is the internet in terms of bandwidth.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm aware, the only codec there that could really be released in a patent-free way is Dialer, because it sort of approaches the problem from a new angle, purely to bypass all the existing patents. So assuming that comes to fruition, that would actually allow a patent-free codec or liberally patent-licensed codec in a way that previous ones couldn't, because there was so much legacy codecs, so many legacy patents on all the little things that needed to come together.
So good. It sounds good. It sounds positive. I hope it happens.
It does. Yeah, it's obviously still early days, but let's hope. Second up in the Lightning news, Lilo is to end development after far too many years. Not far too many years, lots of years.
Lilo?
Lilo, the Linux loader.
Yeah, but isn't it Lilo, or do you call Linux Linux?
What do you call that thing you float on a pool? Yeah.
Mm. You don't Lido. You go swimming in a Lido.
Yeah, and you take your Lilo with you to float on the Lido.
Yeah.
But you're right, Mike. I guess it does represent a Linux loader. My first.
These are important issues.
It makes me feel quite nostalgic, actually, for the old days, because I think for many of us with old Mandrake installs, Lilo was the default. It seems so straightforward and simple and always looked better than Grub.
Yeah, I reinstalled. I finally gave up on my deep BTRF issue yesterday and reinstalled. Ubuntu, and oh my god, the amount of difficulty I got in with the bootloader, it was an absolute nightmare. The reason is my BIOS can boot both UEFI and non-UEFI systems in a way that makes a complete mockery of secure boot.
Like most PCs do.
Yeah. So I booted up the Ubuntu LiveCD, clicked install, but for some reason, it defaulted to the UEFI version of Ubuntu booting off the USB stick, even though there's both boot systems on there. And once you've booted it into UEFI, you can't then install the legacy thing. But you can't install the legacy thing into a boot partition that's already... So you can't install the UEFI thing into a boot partition that's already using the legacy thing. It would have made everything else unbootable, etc., etc. And it just made me nostalgic for the old times when stuff was simple. You just hit install Lilo and it worked.
Yeah.
The rest of the installer took about 10 years to work out what was going on. But the actual boot thing was easy.
Yeah. I've had the same problem, actually, where booting off the live CD would only ever go through the old BIOS. I had to create a UEFI installation alongside my other distributions, I had to put it on a USB stick and boot live off that from Refind or some of the live UEFI boot thing. It was awful. And also it's completely unobvious. People who have normal people are going to be completely clueless as to what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I ended up just turning off secure boot support in the BIOS, and that solved it for me. But it's one of these things, it always makes you a little bit sad when like good software comes to an end. But it may be the right time for Lilo or Lilo.
Mm. Grub is complicated, and getting Grub to multi-boot is difficult, I find, especially alongside, increasingly Windows and OS X as well, which it supports.
I've never had an issue. I just do update Grub, and...
I can't get it to boot Windows 8. But I've not looked into it that often because I don't boot into Windows 8 that much, but it's complicated.
You're too modern for me. Mine boots Windows 7 just fine. Right, next up on the Lightning news. Unity comes to Ubuntu.
Is this running Exmir?
Possibly. No, this is a Unity game engine in a brilliantly confusing naming clash. Currently, they describe it as experimental support, so they could discontinue it. They haven't pledged to keep building it, but they've made it available to if game developers want to start working on Linux.
Does this mean we're going to get any particular Unity-based games coming to Linux anytime soon?
No, the game engine itself, as in games made with it, have supported Linux for quite a while. Building the game.
I understand, okay.
It was one of the most requested features, I think, on the Unity development forums. And I think Unity must be perhaps the most popular middleware games engine creation toolkit.
Yeah, it's certainly, if it's not, it's certainly very close to being so.
You can develop Unity games now for free, effectively.
Yeah, and I think the good news for this, particularly from the Linux point of view, is that if you do get developers working on Linux, that's bound to lead to much better Linux support for games.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at the moment, it's just sort of seen as an unwanted stepchild. Sometimes none of the developers use Linux, or some user requested it, just hit the compile for Linux button across your fingers.
I think, and I've known a few people working in a couple of game studios, and I think there's a general desire with developers to work like in Linux. They find it a much better environment than working with Windows, which is constantly plagued by updates and all the usual stuff. And it's not so much like Linux support for Linux sake, but in fact that it makes it's just much more developer friendly and easier to create a development environment and work with that. So I really hope it succeeds.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of developers also work in macOS, but I'd imagine that's not as popular in gaming because certainly on the MacBooks you don't have the real graphics power that you can get. So yes,
and the future
sounds like it.
Yeah.
So yeah, next up in the lightning news, the Raspberry Pi Touch display. This is the official display from the Raspberry Pi Foundation. It's $60, not including tax or shipping. 7 inches, 10-point capacitive touchscreen, 800 by 480 pixels, and mounting holes for the Raspberry Pi. So this is fairly unimpressive spec as far as screens go, but the point of it isn't to be the latest and greatest screen. It's to be a single screen that will be supplied for many years, will be tough, will work. It's not a fly-by-night thing that will constantly change, and in 6 months to a year there won't be another version that will break compatibility with everything else.
Yeah, that makes sense, because when I first saw the price, I was a bit confused. I was thinking, I'm sure you can get those screens on Alibaba or whatever websites for $3 or something. But yeah, as an official product, which you know will definitely work without any major issues, I guess that's fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have pointed out that you can get a tablet with 7 inches and better specs than the screen alone for less than this money.
Yeah. But it's still relatively cheap. How does it connect to the Pi?
There's two connectors on the Pi, one for the camera and an almost identical looking one.
Oh, right. Is that like DSi or something?
That's DSi, but the screen itself isn't DSi. It's a parallel interface, so there's a little converter board.
Oh, okay.
Because it was probably about a year ago now, I was speaking to Evan about this, and he said that they had the stock, but they couldn't get them to pass the electromagnetic emissions specifications because the parallel bus just spits out so much electrical interference.
Yeah, and I remember him saying it had been a huge challenge. It had been something that they'd wanted to do right from the beginning, and you just said, and I think they said it in their blog post, it's all very well choosing a screen, but as soon as Apple or whoever releases a new device, which is like every 6 months, then that screen's no longer made, and that's not what the Raspberry Pi Foundation's about.
No, yeah. I mean, as far as I'm aware, they're still making Model Bs and B pluses.
Yeah.
You know, they keep support. Actually, I think they've dropped support for Model Bs now, but they're still making B pluses. If you're going to build a business or supporting a company, you need to know that they're going to continue making the stuff.
Yeah, and in an educational market as well, it means that, you know, you can base activities around single screens, and it keeps the GPIO ports. And I was just watching a video of some Python toolkit GUI running on the new screen, and it looks great. It looks, you know, you can use your imagination and come up with all kinds of ideas. It's a nice way of expanding it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame they couldn't get it out sooner, but it is
to me it
looks like a good product.
And maybe if the libraries are mature enough and the protocols become popular enough, then there's nothing stopping people like us buying $3 screens from Alibaba.
Yeah, I have no idea how easy it would be.
Because the DSi part required some like proprietary firmware, as I remembered it ages ago. It was never kind of properly part of the spec.
Yeah, I don't know how specific that is to the screen, if you'd need some separate DSi firmware for a different screen.
Yeah.
I've never had to deal with it, I don't know.
No.
So I'll pass us over to our official KDE correspondent now.
Oh, okay.
Graham.
Oh, so Plasma 5.4 has been released, which is like akin to the KDE desktop. It's really good. We've covered it in the issue of the magazine that we've just sent to the printers, so there's more about it in issue 20 of Linux Voice. But I know... I'm just amazed that more people don't use KDE because I think it's great, and this is a solid update. The great thing, the best feature I think, because I use a high DPI display, I've got Arch running on a MacBook, is that there's now this really easy to use slider that scales everything on the screen, so you don't have to hack around increasing font sizes and stuff like that. And I think that's a great solution to a problem that's getting more and more important as more and more screens have more and more pixels. I saw the first 4K smartphones released like last week or something, which is incredible. You know,
I think you asked why more people don't use KDE. I think the thing is, I know if I end up running KDE, I'd end up running loads of non-KDE software on top of it, like Firefox and LibreOffice, and then these awesome features like high DPI integrated throughout the desktop, it wouldn't work quite the same in these other applications. And
that's true. I mean, I know Firefox is specific to itself, though. It has its own high DPI settings in the config, even if you ran it on GNOME.
Yeah, yeah. I just say if there was a really, really good KDE office suite, and some people say Caligroid is, you know, and a web browser, maybe Qt browser, whatever is, you know, if I could get a really good integrated desktop with all the applications I need, I think that would make me more likely to use KDE. But as I use a lot of GTK stuff, that's one of the reasons I stick with XFCE.
Yeah. I use quite a few GTK apps as well, and I don't use the, yeah, but I use it mainly, I like the way that it looks and reacts, and I like the way that it whenever I need to do something, there's usually a way of doing it in KDE. I use it like almost as a tiling window manager. I have shortcuts to snap windows to different parts of the screen. I use the virtual desktops a lot. I use the Kicker launcher all the time.
How much configuration do you normally have to do to KDE out of the box? Is it a big job these days to get it set up as you like it?
I think so, yeah. I'm lazy and copy across my .kde folder, so I haven't done it for 18 months, but I hate having to go through all that again and making it just how I like it.
But yeah. The desktop's pretty good with backward compatibility then. If you just copy .kde, everything tends to be back where it was.
Yeah, I haven't had a problem for a while. It does sometimes create issues, but since the 5 kind of revisions became stable. Also, the other thing that we didn't actually cover in the magazine is that the latest applications bundle is almost ready as well, and that includes like ports of KMail, which I use, and Dolphin, the first version of File Manager for the KDE5 frameworks, which is, you know, looks almost the same as the old one, but now compiles against the latest libraries. So I think, you know, it's down in certain ways. So maybe you can't become a KDE user. Maybe it's just KDE people, you know, like things the way that they are, and that's the way that it is. I don't know, but I think it's such a great desktop now. And it's one of the only ones that's still an old-fashioned desktop in that way. You know, XFCE is a good other example.
Yeah, it's not desperately trying to appeal to touch displays and new paradigms and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you going to go KDE on your phone when it gets stable?
I'll give it a go. I said I'd give it a go last time we did a podcast. I haven't given it a go. Although that is one of my finds, is to talk about something on my phone. So.
And that really is the news.
Okay, so it's now time for Finds of the 3 weeks. Is there a word for 3 weeks?
Thwartnight.
Thwartnight. Mike actually very helpfully asked the IRC channel if they got any finds, which has now resulted in several pages of finds, which is going to be a nightmare to scroll through.
Sorry, Graham. Problems. We've got too many finds.
Are there any finds you wanted to highlight, Mike, while I have a look?
Tempted to log in now and just start bashing the keyboard. See how quickly.
Let me have a look. I'm scrolling through here now. There was lots of stuff about retro games. Yeah. Lots of people digging out their Amigas. Oh, Andy Barlam has written this rather cool little Lemmings-like game for Android. It's called Rabbit Escape, and it's totally free software. He sent me an early version just based on built in Java. It must have been like 6 months ago or something, and it was pretty good, but very, very basic. And I think he's improved it a lot since then. So yeah, have a look at it on the Play Store. Rabbit Escape. What else there did was, we get?
There was that Elf binary, 166 bytes.
Oh yeah, there's an awesome page about shrinking binaries down as low as possible by hacking the ELF file format, so you can do ridiculous amounts of code. Somebody did a brain, let's say brain flip language interpreter in like 166 bytes.
I like this when we're both doing it together. It makes it so much easier.
Inom M talked about a social meeting group in Stockholm called the Classical Code Reading Group, and they read out bits of source code from the BSDs and like the BSD version of Env and stuff like that.
Isn't there a website that has the links for the source code read out?
Oh yes, it was like on /.radio, wasn't it, or something? Yeah. Large Monster mentions vimdiff. Somebody suggested we have a rant to the Fortnite suggestion, which is quite a good idea. We used to have rants and raves, didn't we, as an old section?
We did back in the day, yeah.
Yeah, the Classical Code Reading Group. My find is streetlife.com, locality-based social networking. It's already turned up some useful things right on my doorstep. Recommendations for gardeners, a customer for a friend, Spanish tuition business, that sort of thing. That's from Still Void. That's a good idea, because I quite like when you visit somewhere, Google, if you put in food, Google will suggest good places to eat, except for, you know, it's Google. There's quite a few finds there. There's enough to keep going. Lots of discussions about Amiga, in fact. We were talking about getting our Amigas out of the attic. And what was the window manager that somebody suggested it might have been brought back to life?
Ami WM was an Amiga-like window manager that I first used back in 1998. I was very, very happy to get an Amiga window manager on my new Linux box, because I'd sadly accepted that the Amiga was dying at that point. And it wasn't updated for absolutely ages. I don't think it would even compile with modern X servers. And one of the people on our IRC channel said that apparently there's been a new update to the code, at least. The website is still a billion years old, but that's something I want to do, and I'll try and get it working, maybe even review it in the magazine.
There's been a couple of things on Hacker News recently about graphical window managers. I'm just looking at one now for the Commodore 64, Geos.
And there is Geos, one for, yeah.
Geos, I remember Geos.
There's one for an 8-bit Amiga as well. I'm just trying to search for it.
8-bit Amiga? No such thing existed, as far as I'm aware.
Oh, I could be getting confused. I didn't understand Amigas anyway.
What computers did you have then, Ben? If you weren't lucky enough. A what?
Commodore.
64?
Yeah.
And then you went straight from that to what, the PC?
No, to Acorn.
Archimedes?
Yeah, A3000.
Wow, you were using ARM chips way before they were cool then.
Yeah.
Well, should we go on with the finds while Ben's Googling up the window environment?
Mm-hmm. I've had a couple sent to me again, so I didn't have to do any work last 3 weeks.
Nice.
Thanks.
Work.
I love our listeners. First one goes as follows. My name is Darius Sosnovsky, and I listen to your Linux Voice podcast. I think you all do a great job promoting Linux and open source stuff. I have something that could be interesting for the finds of the Fortnite section. At GitHub, there is a repository named vimclutch. The basic idea of the project is to create a physical pedal that can be used to control the mode in which Vim, the text editor, currently works. When the pedal is pressed, Vim goes into insert mode, and when it's released, Vim goes back to normal mode. Good luck with the work on Linux Voice. Thanks, Darius. I had a quick check on Amazon, and you can buy one of these USB foot switch pedal things for like $10, basically, sort of throwaway price. And imagine those are quite useful for certain editors or programs where you have to, you know, like Emacs as well, where there's so much use of control. I know a lot of people remap control to caps lock to make it more accessible, but yeah, if you've got RSI or something, but you still want to use these text editors, then perhaps pressing a switch with your foot is way better than having to deal with these crazy key combos. And then I got a find from Nathaniel Olander, who says, I've recently been doing a fair bit of work setting up my Raspberry Pi 2 as a Minecraft /web server, and I've been using GNU Screen a lot. I always found it a pain having to attach and detach until I found the correct TTY for whatever I wanted to do. So I began looking into the ability to name screen TTYs. It turns out it's fairly easy. All you have to do, instead of just typing screen, you type screen dash capital S your name here. The TTY name must have no spaces. If it has a space, screen will attempt to execute whatever follows the first word. Keep up the good work, guys. Always great listening to the podcast. Keep calm and Linux on. Thanks for that. I'm not sure why people use screen over tmux. I thought tmux did everything that screen does, but better. But then I don't know.
Maybe habit. I started using screen, so I've kind of stuck with screen, even though I know tmux is... I mean, I even wrote about tmux and screen in the magazine.
Yeah, I only switched over to tmux relatively recently, and I just stuck with screen just because it was the first thing I learned. And yeah. Inertia is a hard thing to get over.
So, yeah, thanks, guys. If anybody else wants to email me, they're fine, so I can spend more time sitting in the Oktoberfest, then that'd be great. Cheers.
Shall I go next?
Yeah.
So, one quick discovery is that, you know, Elite Dangerous, I haven't had much time to play it. Actually, I haven't played it really for months. But I did get it running on my Linux Steam box, but this is purely by streaming it from the Windows 8 machine I just admitted to having. And the streaming feature in SteamOS is really good, and good enough to play, especially good enough to play something like Elite Dangerous, which most of the time doesn't require the fastest reactions. Maybe it does if you get into an elite dogfight. But the streaming from the Windows PC to a Linux PC works really well, and I've just got, you know, SteamOS installed on a PC under the television. The other thing is that I've got one of those Meizu MX4 Ubuntu phones, and I thought after playing with Ubuntu for the last, I don't know, couple of months, I'd try putting Android on it. This is something that quite a few people have tried for a variety of reasons, and everybody gets stuck at a certain point. But I've been able to get the very latest version of Android, at least from the Meizu form, which is they put on a little Flyme OS over the top of it. It's like a skin. And it's been a hell of an adventure trying to get it to work, because I might actually write about this in a later issue. I now know quite a lot about how Android phones work and about their file systems and boot processors. Basically, the Ubuntu phone, there is a recovery image for the Ubuntu phone. It's a different kind of file system and partition layout to Android, and which means that while you can flash Android onto the MX4, you can even update it with one of the first over-the-air updates. It won't go any further when it gets to Lollipop, because Lollipop requires the same kind of partitioning as the native MX4 phones that do run their version of Android and Lollipop. And so the solution is to download the update from Meizu's website, and updates for Lollipop come as a system.dat file that's hidden within an update.zip file. There are Linux tools to unzip that file effectively and build an image file out of it. An image file is basically a disk image that you can kind of do the equivalent of DD to your phone, but you use fastboot from the boot partition that onto the phone. That will work with the latest updates. You have to also do the boot, the same to boot.image, which contains the kernel and the RAM disk for the phone's drivers. And also, it's very dangerous, and you're very likely to brick your phone if you do try it. I did exactly this. I bricked my phone. Really lucky that this is, at least the Ubuntu images are open source. The Ubuntu images are completely downloadable. That includes the partitioning information. So bricking your phone, it wouldn't even turn on. It doesn't do anything. But when you plug in a bricked phone into your Linux box, there is some kind of slight flickering of life. Enough life, in fact, that you can restore the Ubuntu image back to it and then try again. And you can also flash back to Ubuntu as well, because the complete image for Ubuntu is there. And there was something else that I wanted to mention about it. Yes, and in reflashing, the other great danger is that you write over the VRAM for your phone, which contains its serial number and also the IMEI number, which is what the networks use for registering your device on the networks and for tracing you and tracking you. And I think even in some countries it's illegal to change your IMEI number. But I found a way of doing that as well by basically rooting the phone and getting a tool to access the Android engineering mode, which and there's a mode there which will take AT commands. Do you remember that from the old modems? And there is an AT command that you can enter that will change the IMEI number for your phone. And so I don't think this is illegal, because luckily on the MX4 box there was my old IMEI number, so I was able to reflash my old number back into the VRAM part of the operating system and get the phone back up and running, just in case anyone else has the same problems.
That deserves a round of applause for geekiness, I think.
It's really geeky, yeah. I feel, yeah, it's good. It was. I could actually go on about it because I spent hours and hours trying to get this to work.
A couple of years ago when the first images for Ubuntu Phone or Ubuntu Touch were released, I got it dual booting with Android on my Nexus 7. Is that not still possible?
You can dual boot it on the Nexus, but I think it's really missing the option on the official Ubuntu phones.
Okay.
So yeah, because on the Nexus phones you can run the Clockwork Mod recovery boot manager, so you can basically switch between the two different ROMs. You can't. There is a Chinese version of Clockwork Mod for the MX4, and so you can kind of use that, but I haven't been successful in getting it to boot between two different operating systems. They're my finds, kind of not finds really.
Shall I go next?
Yeah, sure.
So my first find this fortnight is a graphical OS for the Atari 8-bit.
Is that for the Atari 800?
No idea. This is another of the old machines that I don't know, because I only had the Commodore. anyway, there's details about it at atari8.co.uk/GUI, and it will tell you all about Atari machines that I've never seen.
The Atari 800 was a really great machine. It had a great color palette and some brilliant alternate reality running on the Atari 800 XL was one of the best versions of that game.
I've got a few more finds that I even found before we started recording. Google's new logo, which we're going to get onto a little bit, but the thing that impressed me about it is you can render it in a 290-byte SVG.
Mm.
That is tiny for an image file.
Yeah.
I mean, Google serves so much data that saving a few bytes here and there really doesn't make that much difference to them. But just, and you know, when you look at all the adverts that are spewed across most websites these days, that the logo's neither here nor there. But I was just quite surprised that you could get an image that small.
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking at it now. I guess it is mostly primitive, so.
Exactly. That's all rendered in brush strokes.
Oh, right.
Around circles.
Right, okay.
What else? Oh, yeah. As I said, I've just reinstalled Ubuntu on my machine, or I said a bit earlier, and I've using Firefox. And I've for quite a while I've been using Chrome for these Hangout sessions that we use to record the podcast, and I'm using Firefox this time. And I actually wasn't aware it was possible, but it is. But you just get spewed with messages asking you whether you want to allow or deny plugins to access all various bits of your computer. It must have, six or seven of them must have come up, and I've clicked on allow. But it's one of those things where you're thinking, hang on, this is happening here. What else is Google? What other pages do I go to in Google Chrome where it just allows access to all my machine without me knowing? Just got one other find, and that's strml.net, which is a website that sort of, as it loads, it renders the CSS that renders the page itself, so you see it, the page change as the CSS loads,
like a memory monitor for web browsers.
Yeah, so that's quite a cool website to have a look at. And those are my finds this fortnight.
Cool. Have you found anything, Andrew?
I've not found anything Linux related. But I did find a really cool castle at the weekend. Bamborough Castle.
Oh, yeah, that is amazing, that place.
Which is great. Absolutely fantastic. It's got just the right amount of... Normally, I like the castles to be sort of ruins that you can run around and pretend to be Strider. But a lot of castles are just more like glorified stately homes, and I don't like that. Bamborough sort of strikes the right balance for me, in that you can go up on turrets and walls and things, and then also look at the collection of, I don't know, pottery and boring stuff that they've got. But there was quite a cool museum in there about the Lord Armstrong, who made loads of guns and was one of those fantastic Victorian industrialist types. Gave a lot of patents to the government, and was the owner of the first house to be lit by electric lighting in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite a cat.
If you like running around castles pretending to be Strider,
yes.
There's a place in Ethiopia with castles that's called Gondor.
To be fair, Bamborough was far enough away. I'm not sure I could be bothered to drive to Ethiopia.
I had another find, actually, which is, I'll try and keep brief, but it was, I went to the Bristol Maker Fair. It was like a small Maker Fair. I met Ben there. And one of the coolest things that they had there is a project by some people at the Bristol University. And it was this small robot with two cameras for eyes. And in a different room, it was connected to a Linux machine, and then another Linux machine, which was running Ubuntu, and connected to the other machine running Ubuntu was an Oculus Rift. And you went into this other room and put the Oculus Rift on your head.
Cool.
You could see through the eyes of the robot. And they'd also got a Kinect, you know, like a Microsoft's motion detection system, connected to the Ubuntu machine that's connected to the Oculus Rift to detect your motion. And so when I moved my arms and when I moved my body and moved my head, the robot would move its head and I was looking through the eyes of the robot.
That's epic.
The thing is that it was amazingly immersive. So I wasn't in the same room as the robot. In where the room with the robot was, there was a mirror. So you could turn your head and look. And I looked at myself as a robot and I totally felt like I was a robot. So... My plan is to actually become immortal and to sever my head from the rest of my body and keep it alive somehow and just wear an Oculus Rift and live the rest of forever as a robot.
Did you harm a human, or through your inaction allow a human to come to harm?
No, but you could. So I could sing and I could dance. I could do like cheesy dad dances to the other people in the room and point at them. Apparently my zombie walk was really impressive.
Did you do the robot voice while you were a robot?
You know something I did, and all I could see through the robot eyes was a load of embarrassed stares. Excellent. So Maker Faires are great. I need an Oculus Rift and a robot.
Was that the first time you'd used a Rift?
Yes, it was, actually, yeah.
What did you make of it, then?
Well, it was pretty different. I didn't try anything else on the Oculus Rift. I mean, the field of view I was initially very disappointed with. I mean, much narrower than the pair of glasses that I'm wearing, which is kind of what I'd expected. I've been playing with that. It was Ben's find of the Google Cardboard, and I still play with that on occasion.
Cardboard thing is very cool.
And it wasn't like a million miles away. It wasn't hugely different. The latency was obviously low, and it was obviously a hack anyway, putting it into the robot. But
I wonder if it was one of the older models, because they have released a few different developer kits, haven't they?
So. I'm still hugely excited by the whole idea of, of virtual reality. I've taken over the find section. And that is all of our finds, almost as long as the news section.
That brings us to our halfway reminder. Still to come, we have the Vocalize Your Neurons and our Voice of the Masses, which is going to be a lightning voice of the masses this time. If you like the sound of that, but would prefer it in paper or PDF or maybe even EPUB format with absolutely no DRM whatsoever, you can subscribe to our magazine, Linux Voice, at shop.linuxvoice.com, or just buy it in Tesco, Asda, Barnes & Noble, WH Smiths, wherever you want.
Awesome. Which brings us neatly on to Vocalize Your Neurons, which I think is the best section in the podcast. So, first off, we have a neuron from Andreas Zweili. He says, I recently decided to install an XMPP messaging server on my VPS. Since I like to play around with Linux and similar stuff, I was prepared to dedicate some time to it. To my great surprise, it took me circa 10 to 15 minutes to have it running on a clean Ubuntu system. OTR, off-the-record encrypted chat, works totally fine, and I look forward to trying GPG encryption. When it is so easy to set up something really secure, why are governments even bothering with trying to cripple consumer products? I can hardly believe that the really dangerous people are using WhatsApp. Thanks, Andreas. I think you've got a very valid point there. Yeah. The Taliban in Afghanistan are not running around chatting on IRC and stuff. They're exchanging messages on pack horses. And so,
well, they probably are as well.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I think you're overestimating dangerous people, to be honest.
There is also a strong element of security theatre, isn't there? I mean, that's Bruce Schneier's phrase for, you know, making people take off their belts when they go through airport metal detectors. Take off your shoes. You know, people will feel safer if they see other people taking off their shoes.
Yeah.
If you know that somebody's WhatsApp is being monitored, then you might feel a bit safer. Even though you're not safer, you might just feel safer, which is important.
That's more important, yeah.
Well, to a large extent, it is.
There's an interview in issue 20 of Linux Voice with Matthew Garrett, in which he talks about a great many things, but he talks about the fact that a few of his friends actually have had their laptops taken when going through customs. And one of the things that you can't be certain of is how the laptop's been tampered with, whether it's, you know, a piece of BIOS malware has been installed. So in security in that way is quite important, especially when you know everything from the ground up that's running.
It was quite a good piece I came across recently about securing stuff going through airports, and it only works in America. But if you're worried about your stuff being tampered with by the TSA and all that, oh, the cat's just jumped on the desk. he's going for my microphone. Get out of the way, Zappa.
We've got a new guest presenter.
So if you just go through the airport with your regular bag, then obviously they're allowed to go in it and poke about. Oh, I've got a tail in my face.
Somebody screenshot this.
Zapper, off. Oh, he's going to sleep on my keyboard. Zapper, off. There you go. Right, yeah, if you go through with a regular bag, you have to hand it over and it can be looked at by whoever. They're even allowed to cut it open if you lock it and all that. If you go through with a gun in your bag, you're legally allowed to do this, but you have to make it so that they're not allowed to tamper with it in case they did something like that. So you have to go through with basically a locked metal box with luggage, and not one of those little locks with that the airport's officials can open with the master key, a properly secure lock, and they're not allowed to go into it. So there's this ludicrous situation that if you want to travel securely in America, you have to put a gun in your luggage.
Wow.
Excellent. Encrypt your messages onto the bullet cases.
Oh, you're not allowed bullets.
Drats. Those pesky kids.
They already knew what I was going to do.
I think they've thought of everything.
So moving on to the second neuron, which is from Ryan Seal. He says, in episode 14 of the podcast, I heard you all talking about how you wish there was a smaller, lighter, less bloated Firefox. Well, believe it or not, someone out there has basically taken the Firefox source code and built a lighter version called Light Firefox on SourceForge. Basically, it looks like this guy has taken the Firefox source code and built it changing a few compiler options. He offers 64-bit builds. Builds it with the multi-process feature ES10.
He removes the PDFJS support, so that particular vulnerability doesn't apply to users of his builds. He removes some other things that users might find useful. The reason I stopped using it is because he removes Ogg Vorbis support, Opus support, WebRTC support, and the developer tools, and some extensions don't work. Anyway, I just thought it was an interesting find. And I love the podcast, love the philosophy of the magazine. Thanks there, Ryan. I wonder why the developer of Light Firefox removed Ogg Vorbis support and Opus support. I mean, okay, they are extra layers of code. They are extra potential security vulnerabilities, but...
Maybe just reading web pages, that's all he wants to do with it.
Well, it's probably the same as the PDF reader. You can still listen to Ogg Vorbis, etc., but you just do it in an external program.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true, actually, yeah, and that's more the Unix way, isn't it? Separate programs working together rather than one giant program trying to do everything. So, yeah, thanks, Ryan. If anybody else wants to their neurons to be vocalized, email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
Thanks, Mike. It's time now for Voice of the Masses, which, as I said, is going to be a very short Voice of the Masses, because the masses have spoken. They've spoken resoundingly. Voice of the Masses, does Linux need a new Linux mascot? Now, I'm sick of Tux's stupid fat face looking at me. It's just a piece of rubbishy clip art that was chosen at random back when Linux was young, and people had no idea that it would be installed on tens of millions of machines around the world. Probably if they thought that, they might have put more effort into, you know, doing a better job of it. But it's appalling. So what we asked is, you know, is it time for Tux to be changed? Do we need a new mascot? Something livelier, a mascot that encapsulates the spirit of freedom and sharing. Maybe like one of those, you know, an American bald freedom eagle carrying a cornucopia in its claws. Something like that. Or are you okay with him as he is, to show that we're not obsessed with marketing and making mega books? Let us your thoughts below. Let us know your thoughts below, and we'll read out the best in our upcoming podcast. We won't actually read out the best. We'll just pricey it very quickly. So Kevin O'Brien says, this has to be the oddest Voice of the Masses yet.
That's saying something.
Yes.
For what problem do you see this as a solution anyway? If boredom is the reason, try going to a movie or something.
Thanks for that. 38 people responded, so it obviously means something to some people.
Plus, a movie's like a tenner, and that's another tenner if you want popcorn.
That's,
yeah, can't afford to go to the movie every time.
Just
bored.
Don't want popcorn.
Or babysitter.
Hey. And Frank says, Frank says, this is much ado about not much of anything, started by someone who had a deadline and nothing to write about. So that's those out the way.
But I like the way that implies all our other Voice of Masses are carefully considered over, you know, the course of a couple of weeks.
But to be fair, he does quite kindly assume that we give ourselves a deadline to the podcast and stick to it.
Oh dear.
So the reason is not, I mean, obviously we do have deadlines and we do have, actually no, we don't just have space to fill regardless. You know, if we don't have, you know, decent ideas, we're just generally just not bother doing it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But no, the reason that we came up with this, that we asked the internet this question, is because of a letter sent to us by Sultan of Swing in issue 19 of the magazine. He says, as I mentioned in LV019 letters, the current Podgy Tux looks a little embarrassing and is hard to recognise in monotone print as it looks like an ink splat. I would love to keep Tux and think the penguin is well known as a Linux mascot, but it does need updating and or streamlining a bit. Our OS of choice is lean and speedy, like a penguin in water, so why not find a way of integrating that concept into a redesign? That's about the only pro... Oh, hang on, no, sorry.
Oh, really? I've not looked at the... I never look at the responses because I don't like to spoil the surprise when it comes to the podcast recording.
Well, Craig Walsh says Tux is long overdue a redesign, but if you look at other brands' logo changes throughout the years, they improve on the original rather than replacing it with something completely different. Tux just needs to go on a diet and buy some new clothes. pretty much...
I completely agree with this personally.
Yeah, I do.
I think we should keep the penguin, but get rid of Tux and make the penguin good. Make it mean something.
Yeah.
Yeah, make it a good penguin. And I think branding is really important. It's, you know, fair enough. Anyone listening to this probably already uses Linux, is probably already aware of it. That's not who the branding's for. The branding's for the billions of people who have never heard of Linux. And it needs to make you excited to try it. A fat penguin sat on his bottom doesn't make you excited to try it. It needs to have the cool factor. It needs to be something that people get behind. You know, the famous picture of the guy with the Apple logo shaved into the back of his head. It makes you want to do that.
Yeah.
No one's going to get Tux shaved into their head.
I've seen Tux tattoos.
Yeah.
I think that may have been some of the motivation behind or inspiration behind Andrew's drawing of the Tux of the old podcast. I remember his being like a cubist, avant-garde, modernist approach.
It was a Nouvelle Vague Rococo.
Yeah, that was it. That was it.
Baroque ensemble. Brutalism out of black, yellow, and white. Right. So many people say pretty much similar to Stephen Wheeler, who says, like it or not, Tux is associated with Linux. Lots of famous companies and organisations have terrible branding, but we forget about it because we're used to it. Think about it. Would we really call a modern oil company Shell and have such a simple logo? For me, the Beatles is a terrible name for a band, but we don't think about it because they were so good. Companies and corporations that have rebranded have come in for a lot of flack. Remember the BT rebranding in the 80s? Tux has Linux, and that's just the way it is.
You see, the two examples he used are actually, I think, are reasonably well-branded. I mean, the Shell logo, it's simple. You can render it on any size and anything, and it's instantly recognisable as a Shell. Same with the Beatles, that sort of serif font, Beatles, you know.
But he's saying
you
don't think of it as what it is. You don't think of it as a Shell. And in fact, I don't often think of it as a Shell or the Beatles for what the Beatles means as a word. You've just got so used to identifying it as the brand. And I suppose that has already happened with Tux.
It hasn't, because it's Tux. When you see that penguin, you don't think Linux, you think Tux. It's not, you know, it's not the way the Shell logo is to Shell. It's not the way the Beatles are to the Beatles. It's still separate. He's a thing, not a logo for Linux.
Also, the Shell logo has been rebranded several times over the company's history, which is what Stephen Wheeler was talking about. Keep the concept of the Shell or the Penguin, but just tweak it it goes better with more modern typefaces or print techniques or whatever.
I completely agree with that as well. I'm with you, Ben. I think that's what we've got. The Penguin. It's great that we've got something that's identifiable and it's Linux and it's. Try and do something with that.
Omnifer's implementer says, can't change from Tux, no way, but yes, he could go on a diet and cheer him up a bit. He looks like he just farted, isn't a bit embarrassed. Les W, it's an odd if not unfortunate logo, but let's work with it. Look at Starbucks, their siren logo has nothing obvious to do with coffee, but today it's a recognisable brand worldwide. It's somewhat different from the original version, so let's do something with Tux. Smarten him up. Top Cat and Kane, maybe, to imply quality. He'll scrub up just fine. Colin, 6128. Tux is fine. I have one on my desk, grinning at me as inspiration while trying to learn my way through the tutorials. Gnight, you're right. GNU Linux does need a different logo. Some other animal. Fast, majestic, wild and free. Like a wildebeest or something.
like a herd of wildebeest.
RG, is there a reason for a new mascot logo? Tux isn't no longer compelling, but he can be redesigned by students engaged in FOSS. That's a terrible idea. Almost every FOSS project has an awful website that's just not been... The hierarchy of information has not been thought about. It's just a right mess. Keep FOSS students away from all branding, I say. Orange Dolphin, I think having a harmless, cute, fat penguin that breaks the marketing rulebook is exactly right. A lion, eagle, or other imperial animal would be a good shot at presenting a face of Linux that we would like people to see, while not presenting the fact that Linux can also be lazy, fat, and generally not perfect. Let's leave the pretense to the proprietors of unfree software, shall we? No, that's not the way it works. You don't go from a fat, rubbishy penguin to a lion. You go from a fat, rubbishy penguin to a better penguin.
I think the one company that's done this quite well with an animal is Sousa. The animal is the chameleon. It's a cuddly, fun chameleon. But they've actually got a good, simple logo based on that. That's not too much. It's instantly recognisable. You can render it in any size. It's associated with Sousa. It's adapted over time to still be look modern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Some thoughtful discussion here. Bruce Wolf, who has as his avatar, I think it's the Amarok logo of a wolf howling at the moon. Yeah. While I have no problem with the current Tux, I also recognise that logos often get freshened up over time. Apple's logo has been refreshed at least once, and Microsoft has refreshed its Windows logo several times. Likewise, many of our favourite distros have refreshed their logo over time as well. My point is, it is common and natural for a logo to evolve, so why not Tux? Mm. A community contest could be held where graphic design artists could offer up their suggestions, and either Linus or some team selected by Linus, after all, he owns the trademark, could choose Tux NG. All good logo updates retain the essence of the original, hence not going for lions, eagles, etc. So I would expect the Tux penguin to still be the essence of any new design, or we could stick with the current Tux. Ultimately, Linus probably needs to make the call. Or cheerfully delegate someone else to make the call because he just doesn't care. Eponymous me has replied to that with, the reason logos get refreshed is generally because the company needs a bump or a change of image. Linux is in neither of these categories. Therefore, there is neither need nor desire to alter the logo. P.S. Is the Tux logo broken? Personally, I would say no. I would say yes. Remember when the post office was going to change to Consignia? They paid a fortune for the privilege of acquiring a new market research-led brand, only they obviously did not ask anyone with a shred of common sense. If they'd asked me, I would have gratefully accepted millions of pounds to tell them that post office is okay. Consignia is dead in the water.
That is true.
It is true. It's true. It's made me doubt everything that I believe.
Consignia.
What's the? There's a train company that's changed its name to Abellio. It was Southern Rail or Northern Rail or Transpennine Rail or something quite self-explanatory. Abellio, brilliant, thanks lads. It goes on. So many people love Tux as he is. Quite a few people want to keep a penguin, but actually just make it a bit better. Moylan has a great point here. Any distro is free to create a new mascot. Linux users will vote with their feet. It's possible the new mascot would replace Tux, but I doubt it. Now, if you look on all the press releases that Ubuntu has put out about over the last few years about its notebook edition, its TV, its phone, Linux doesn't really get mentioned all that much because the operating system is Ubuntu, the brand is Ubuntu, and it's true that your Canonical, Sousa et al, Android, Google can do a much better job of branding and making something that will sell to the public. But I think if Linux were a bit better branded, then it would get a bit more recognition from those third-party projects. At the moment, it seems to me that Android is a great example of this, that other companies that are taking on Linux just really want to distance themselves from it because it has a reputation for being hard and maybe a wee bit amateurish. But if it were you know, refreshed, made more, slightly more corporate, not, you know, not a, not Consignia standard, then it, you know, it might get a bit more acceptance. I don't know.
I think a good example of this is, I don't know if they still did it, but back in the day when you used to get a computer and it had the Intel Inside logo on it, even though the computer wasn't an Intel, it, you know, it had an Intel chip, but lots of other parts from other things, it was such a good thing to have Intel Inside. It was a...
Yeah.
Exactly. And Linux doesn't have that. It's not, ooh, that's got Linux, it must be good. It's something else. Ignore the middle bit. And it needs to have that branding to make it an exciting thing that people want to put their name to. Ubuntu say it's Ubuntu rather than Ubuntu Linux because they don't think that the Linux bit adds to their brand. No. And that's because the Linux brand itself isn't strong enough.
They're absolutely right. It would detract from their brand.
Mm.
Benz says, Mr. Flibble. Mr. Flibble, of course, was a penguin, but not a fat, friendly penguin. An evil, bad penguin. That's really the end of this voice of the masses. I just think everyone else is wrong. Sorry. And this is one of the only times that I've come away from a voice of the masses thinking that. Normally, I get really warm, fuzzy feelings because so much of the internet is hate and ignorance, and you come to Linux Voice. And just everybody's thought about what they, and even when I disagree, I just, there's so much, you know, thought and weight and hinterland gone into the comments. It just makes me feel fantastic. But today, you're all wrong. All of you are wrong. You're wrong.
You heard it first here, listeners. So, on that happy note, is that the end of the podcast?
Well, we should probably say something happy pick us back up from that.
Yeah, even if you're wrong, listeners, keep buying our magazine, please.
we'll put Tux on the cover again, we promise. One day. We should have a competition. We should run a competition, why not? And,
I think we should. Yeah, based on what a lot of people are saying, either it doesn't need redesigning or it does need a slight modification, then everybody can come up with a new tux. And,
or not. Yeah. And then we could put the old tux alongside the new tuxes and see if there's any improvement. We'll ask an impartial group of people what they think and see. We could do that.
That was Richard Stallman.
Yeah, well, maybe we could email Stallman with the pictures and see.
Hang on. Just to get away from any potential accusations that we're more focused on style over substance, thank you to everyone who responded to our reader survey, which we sent out to subscribers, to some subscribers.
A random selection, so we didn't have a billion to process. But
so we've got some good, strong opinions on that, and we're going to use that to improve the magazine, which is what we strive to do daily, apart from when, like, Sundays.
Yeah.
And Mondays after deadline.
Yeah, that's it. But the rest of the time that's all we're trying to do. So thanks for helping us out in that and for trying to make Linux Voice as good as it can be.
Yep, thanks for all the feedback. Everybody who emailed back and left comments as well. We've read every single one of them, and it's very, very useful.
And we had hundreds of responses. It was a fantastic response rate.
And aren't the responses online now, or a graphical representation of them?
I have on our forums. If anybody wants to visit our Linux Voice forums, accessible by the main website, I put up a rather crude hacked-together graph, but it shows basically what people want more of or less of. And it looks like we're doing a pretty good job, but people want more servery stuff, more programming stuff. So, yeah, we're going to try and fill in all those gaps.
That's quite a positive way of ending this episode, isn't it?
Is indeed. So, thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll see you again in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See you.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Bye. It's such a nice day.